Welcome to the Penguin Magic Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Tate. Alongside me, with always, my good buddy, Nick Lacapo. Nick, how you doing?
Doing better. Better than last week.
Yeah, we caught you after a run last week, right?
Well, I'm after a run this week too, but yeah, it's just nicer out. I think last week I probably ran in the snow. This week, mm-hmm. I can see the sky, so we're good.
I was just at the studio, and it's a beautiful day outside, so that means that we have to get inside and podcast.
Yeah, well, it'll probably be like sub 20 tomorrow.
Oh, so. Yeah.
This is how it goes around here.
Well, we were having a look around the website before we popped on here, and there's a couple of new things out that I think we should talk about before we get into the listener topic this week. And
Keymotion. I heard we put out stuff every week. Did you know that?
I couldn't believe it. How do we do that?
Crazy. How is that even a thing? I don't even know. Do you people know how difficult this is?
It is, sometimes people reach out to me and they're like, how do you guys keep doing this week after week? And the answer is, we love it so much, I guess. And this is all we do.
Well, you know, unfortunately the market kind of demands that you put something out every week so that we can only do this, mm-hmm. but, true. Yeah, that's what it is. It's crazy.
Well, Keymotion by Seth Race came out, which is kind of fun. And Dan Harlan is teaching it. So this is a pretty interesting approach to the haunted key.
Yeah, it's kind of not the haunted key. I don't know. It's an animated key, right? Yeah,
I think that's a better way to put it.
Yeah, because the haunted key has got its own vibe, right, where it spins over in your hand using one of those old skeleton keys. It's kind of a classic trick. Have you ever done that trick?
Yeah, you know, I remember back in the day, there was a version of haunted key where you would do the haunted key, and then you would, like, slide the teeth down to the other side.
Yeah, it was that crazy one, right.
Yeah, so I used to do that one at the magic shop I worked in years and years and years ago when I was working retail magic. And that was a lot of fun. But the actual, like, rolling over of the haunted key is every once in a while I find, like, an old skeleton key in somewhere. And I always just do it to make sure I still can. And it's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's a cool thing to know if you've never done it. I know there's a great looking haunted key on the market right now, but this is something completely different. I'd be more interested in performing Keymotion than the haunted key. It looks like a house key, and you place it in the palm of your hand, and it stands straight up.
Like, yeah, it's
on the tip.
Kind of a PK effect, almost.
Yeah.
It's got vibes of the voodoo doll, of the old voodoo doll thing.
I'd be interested. I haven't seen what Dan did with it, like, in his performance. I'd be interested to see how Dan presents it, because I'm sure Dan found a nice justification for the key being possessed, essentially, and standing up on end. But yeah, it's got that great method, because you can't know how that works unless you know that method. Method isn't for everybody, strangely. It's like a very controversial method in magic, but a good one, I always thought.
You know, I kind of think so too. It definitely lives in that world of, like, very, very clever method, but you got to be willing to commit to it, I think we can say.
Yeah, and it's
without giving away the game.
Small commitment, right? Like, yeah, I mean, not for everybody, but, you know, I think you could, if you wanted to do this trick, yeah, the buy-in is not much.
Exactly. It's you know, hats off to Seth Race for putting that out.
Yeah, it's a cool one. It's a cool one.
And then Dragon Scale is still going strong. You know,
yeah, I get a lot of messages about Dragon Scale.
So, well, you know, I did an interview with Magic Orthodoxy that is up, where I basically show everything, and it was pretty cool to see the questions that Orthodoxy had, because, you know, he reviews a lot of magic and he cares about that stuff.
Well, it's still on, like, the first version came out in November, December.
Yeah.
And now we've gotten in some, like, stable updates to the actual app. Mm-hmm. And we got the Facebook group going, and there's people posting things that they're doing with it on there. And it's kind of taking shape. You know, some of the updates we've made to it over the last couple months are really interesting, really, you know, with routines in mind, you know, trying to figure out what do you do with the electronic card scale. It's very cool. So, you know, it's there's a lot of there's ongoing stuff happening with it all the time. You know, I just saw that there was a new, you know, like a, you know, a new update coming. It doesn't have anything major in it, but a new update coming right now. I think it's ready for distribution on the test app. So, yeah, it's we're all working on it. We're all talking about it over there. So, if you have any questions about it, yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, I think you reach out to us and we'll be happy to help you with it.
Yeah, you know, I was having a conversation with Bobby Borgia last night, the booker over at Keller's, and he's been back on cruise ships, and that whole idea of using the scale with a secret assistant backstage, I think he's gonna go play with that and like start to really experiment, which is kind of fun seeing this like wild electronic like used on this grand scale. So I'm excited to see what he does with it.
Yeah, I've come up with some cool stuff. I know you've come up with some cool stuff. I'm seeing cool stuff in the group, and I'm waiting for the ball to drop, you know, like the oh, that is crazy. 'Cause I mean, it's all crazy already, but you know, the one thing that I just want to drop it into my show somewhere for some reason, because of how consistent it is and how well it works. But for right now, I'm still looking for the thing. What is it? I gotta find it.
It's super exciting. I love what people are doing with it. Is there anything else that came out this week or that we
Oh,
know that's
well, there
coming
was
out?
a, you know, sticker kicker is a great trick. Maybe a
Oh,
lot of people are
yeah.
familiar with it, but it was a great Roddy McGee and Jamie Williams thing that came out a couple of years ago. I think it won one of the tricks of the year, one category. And Greg Wilson was in town recently, and he filmed an edition for it. It's like a perfect Gregory Wilson trick, right? It's just like right up his alley. So, if you own Sticker Kicker, like if you're listening to this and you own Sticker Kicker, there is a new tutorial on your account from Gregory Wilson teaching his handling. And if you don't own Sticker Kicker, you should buy it. And if you do, you'll get a new handling from Gregory as well. Just a great trick to do. It's a really, really fun trick to do. And we do that a lot, you know, update tutorials and things. We don't, you know, it's fun. We don't really have the right outlet to let people know about things like that, because the only way we can is by sending an email. And sometimes we don't really get the time to tell people like, hey, there's new stuff been added to this tutorial. And a lot of times people miss their emails, even if we do email about it, right? So it's cool that we can like kind of say that here, because yeah, you might not even know. You probably own Sticker Kicker and you got new content.
Yeah,
Congratulations.
it's Sticker Kicker is so much fun. It's definitely one of those that I want to find a way to do it in my like restaurant gigs, just because it's got that like really fun moment of like being a topological oddity where everything sort of goes crazy. And
Well, there's an element of customization as well, where you can write something underneath the card. So, like, it really could be custom tailored to, you know, Town Hall, the restaurant that you're working on the weekends there. So, yeah, that's another one where, like, Gregory's handling is not too far off from Jamie's and Roddy's, but when you watch it, you're just like, man, there's something. This is great. And there's something here for me to add as well because of the extra layer of customization at the end where you can write on the blank card. So, yeah, that's a killer trick
We
and
should
it's in
say
stock.
that Gregory Wilson's got a really fun presentation with it too, where he's like gambling with your stuff. So he's like taking your items, and then you get the ability to win it all back, which is just
You got to watch the video. He takes this guy's, he fleeces this guy for everything he owns. It's hilarious. I don't recommend doing that unless you're Gregory Wilson, but there is a fun, thing you can do there.
You know, that actually dovetails nicely with a listener question we got, which is someone wanted to know about the routines that we create, both for our own shows and for a lot of the products we work on. And I think it's kind of an interesting question because, you know, so many magicians that I meet do work on their own routines, which are sometimes variations of existing published material, which is totally fine to perform. I mean, like, you know, no one can dictate your relationship with magic. But I know one of the things that you and I do basically every day, it's our job, is taking in products and then transforming them into a routine that other people will want to do. And I was wondering how you started coming up with routines and where you go with it.
Everything I do, every routine that I write for Tricks for Penguin, and I mean, man, maybe we should have some like test cases here or something that I could reference. But
yeah,
everything I do is starts from the idea that I have to teach it.
Yeah.
Right. So, and when you start from that frame of mind, it changes a lot of the ways that you might approach a particular trick or a routine. And I realize that is not an approach that most people would take if you're out there trying to learn a trick, right? Like you might think, oh, Nick learns tricks really fast. Eric learns tricks really fast. I wonder what they do. I've kind of come to realize, and I've thought about this like a lot, maybe recently, a lot of what I do just wouldn't feel relevant, honestly, to a lot of people, because mm-hmm. I basically, when I get a new trick, I write an instructional video mm-hmm. about it, right? And that is not something you would think to do right away. Mm-hmm. Maybe you should do it. I don't know. But so that's the first thing I'm doing, is I have to sit down and script out my instructional video, not word for word, but an outline. Here's the introduction. Here's what you receive. Does there need to be a performance before I show you the props? Or do you need to know the secret before or after you see the props? Or can I sum up the secret in a few minutes? So like, I'm thinking about these things that just have nothing to do with me even performing the trick, right? Mm-hmm. But this is all relevant. And once I have that in there, it's this, I've kind of forced myself to be like, okay, well, this is this basic version that I need to teach now. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not I would have thought about that basic version at all, if I'm just a consumer of the trick, I would have been like, I don't need the basic version, right? No, I have to learn it. Mm-hmm. Because I have to learn the basic version and I have to go do it. And in doing that, I learned something, mm-hmm. you know, something that you probably aren't learning if you are just skipping ahead to the medium. And I get it. I wouldn't want to do the basic version. I'm like, nah, I'm beyond that, but I have to. And I'm telling you that these are the little things that kind of make it unlock it for me, to make it feel like I've done the trick a billion and a half times, when in reality, I kind of haven't. That said, there's an element of experience as well. I have learned a ton of tricks mm-hmm. and taught them. So it does begin to snowball a little bit. I think anybody that's kind of done like a 365-day magic challenge or something might be able to relate, you know, when you learn a trick that you've kind of already learned a different version of in the mm-hmm. past, it can be a little bit easier to routine for it. So that's kind of what ends up happening. Like once I realize what kind of trick I'm dealing with, I might be able to call from previous tricks, mm-hmm. but really the idea that I have to teach it really dictates how I end up like learning the actual routine. Cause I will end up forcing myself to learn parts of this trick that I just wouldn't otherwise, you know? And yeah. When I sit down to learn tricks that I want to learn, like On Edge by Angelo Carbone. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't teach that trick, right? But have I done that trick yet? No, I want to, I really do. But I wonder if I did have to go through the process that Javier went through mm-hmm. in teaching the trick, would On Edge be in my show right now? It might be, it mm-hmm. really, really might be. So I get it. Nobody really approaches learning magic by having to teach it. Because then the next thing is that I actually say it out loud on the camera,
yeah.
right? I teach it and then I sometimes edit myself mm-hmm. teaching it. And that just buries it in my head in a different level mm-hmm. than other tricks.
You know, the teaching it element and approaching it from that direction is pretty amazing, because just speaking for myself, it is that having to get deep inside the trick and learn every aspect of it makes you really focus on different things. You know, I was doing a lot of John Bannon tricks recently, and as a result, I was sort of forced to critically think about my Elmsley count. Because, like, what am I doing? Like, am I displaying these cards? Am I counting them? And it made me really reflect on what I was doing and how I was doing it. And I think that if you learn something with the idea that you have to teach it to somebody else, you are right in that it will force you to become familiar with the tricks in ways that you couldn't be otherwise. And as far as, like, the creation of the routine, trying to think, at least in the aspect of our job, now, and admittedly, you and I get thrown different tricks. Very frequently, I'm representing a fully developed trick. Like a lot
yeah,
of...
Before we go further, I do have tricks in two different buckets here, yeah. right? Like, there are tricks that exist, mm-hmm. and the creator has performed it and thought it through, mm-hmm. like any Bannon trick you got, or yeah. like a Gordon Bean tricks that I did last year. Like,
yeah.
Gordon knows every inch of that script mm-hmm. and why those words are there. But then there's other tricks that are flat out ideas
yeah.
That sometimes we purchase. Sometimes they have routines with them, but they're not routines that are going to end up getting, you know, like great, highly reviewed and like, mm-hmm. you know, something that when you buy it, you're like, wow, that's a great trick. I can do that trick. Like, we need to fulfill that, that check mark there. So mm-hmm. yeah, there really are two different types of tricks.
Yeah. Because, you know, Deface by Martin Breasas is a great example of one where I was basically handed a Ferrari that was already well-tuned and I could just get in the seat and go. I mean, that thing that was well-figured out, well-scripted, everything made sense. And I was just sort of filling in to help the language barrier for customers who might have difficulty understanding Martin, which is something that happens often, right? Whenever we work with somebody who is from outside the US or the UK. Whereas with the incredible Appearing Nothing by Christophe Fouquet, there was a routine, but it didn't really have an end. And I recognized that as a detriment to it, because you kind of had to do it with the close-up mat. And it was really going out and playing with it, this environment, and discovering, oh, figuring out that you can turn those stickers into... turn the holes into stickers made it complete and really took yeah. that routine like across the finish line. And so sometimes just figuring out what that little thing is that it's missing is the hardest part, but one of the most important.
You gotta treat the trick with respect and the idea yeah. with respect. And a lot of the routines come from the fact that we're trying to fill a gap on the tutorial, like especially this is why I'm coming from the tutorial mm-hmm. in that for example, the Malika wallet,
yeah,
right? The Malika wallet, already great. And when you start and you think, you sit down and you start to think about, okay, what's supposed to be on this instructional video, obviously like a card to wallet routine or whatever, but it's not even about that. And this relates to what you just said. It's, mm-hmm. it's like, no, I need to show a basic card to wallet routine. Mm-hmm. So easy, just direct. That's routine number one. Okay. Routine number two, maybe something that I like to do, or like maybe something without a signed card. Okay. That's good. Mm-hmm. I have no routines written. These are just ideas, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm trying to highlight each area of the wallet. Cause the third one would be like
yeah.
the Malika wallet's got that extra pocket where you can show a card in it before the trick starts.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, I have to make a routine for that as well. So it's not even like these were my three favorite tricks. Mm-hmm. They became my three favorite tricks. Right. But when you start from that, like, okay, I need basic handling. I need the named card to wallet. And I also need a handling that shows the future card in the wallet, because that's the features of the wallet. That's what you bought. So you expect to see routines for those things in your wallet. And if you don't see those, you could be disappointed whether you knew it or not, you know? So I wrote routines for those things, not because they were like grabbing me creatively.
Yeah.
They became awesome routines. You know, of course they did, because I'm using the features and you learn things, but But like, yeah, the instructional video dictates like everything that I do. Just like with the Appearing Nothing, man, if it has a crappy ending and you bought it, like, well, or flip it the other way, if you got to be fair to the trick. If you're on the demos, or people are saying in the comments on that trick, like, can only be done at the table, or yeah, it only works with this. Well, that sucks because the trick is great, right? So sometimes you have to create that ending or whatever just to be able to cure that seemingly fault of the trick, right? But in doing so, you make something awesome. It's strange.
It's not just about being respectful to the trick. It's also about being respectful to the creator. Because a lot of times when you're so for whatever reason, I happen to be teaching a lot of Nicholas Lawrence tricks these days, right? It's
Yeah,
just like
I've had
that's
that phase,
yeah. So I'm going through my Nicholas Lawrence glow up phase. And you know, Nicholas is a great creator, but we just live in very different worlds. And trying to figure out like what is, you know, he has a very specific way of creating and a very specific way of approaching his magic, and trying to translate that into something that I can do, which is from a very different perspective, and still maintain his original vision, is incredibly important when you're putting this stuff together. But let's shift over into our own stuff. So when you're putting together routines for your show, where do you, I mean, I know we talked about shows last week, but also we never really like got into the routining of it.
Yeah,
Like
I'm
that's a little
not like,
more, it's a little more nuanced. You know what I mean?
yeah, I again, this is something I've thought about lately because I'm almost in this camp now where, like, do I try to start teaching my own show to myself? You know, what secrets get unlocked when I do that? Because I don't actually do this method for my own stuff. Maybe I need to, but I have never considered myself to be like a creator of magic. I've always loved to start with tricks that I know are already good. There's nothing right or wrong. I know that some people will start with a completely wild and original idea. I would rather start from a point where I know people that I respect have already gotten that trick to a great spot and then can continue from there. You know, like, and just for example, like the Bill and Lemon I first learned from Doc Eason was a killer. I mean, in my opinion, it's just like a perfect trick. There's not much I can't even conceive of changing anything about the thing, from the script to the method and everything. And it was just in my show, and like, and you were around when I was talking about this all the time. I wanted to perform at the Magic Castle, but I didn't want to do the Bill and Lemon because it wasn't really my routine. And you know, I had I created routines up to that point, like, sure, nothing that I'm like, yeah, that's a home run of mine, you know. But under this kind of framework of I can't do this trick anymore. I can't. I could go do it at every venue here in Columbus. Nobody would care. But because I want to work the castle, I can't do that trick anymore. It's got to change. And full well knowing when I change it, it's going to be worse than the Bill Lemon, and maybe never even better than it, right? Because it just can't be that. So, long story short, we worked on the my Bill and card routine. That it's crazy. So now whenever I float a card in my show, and then that card goes away, and then I borrow a bill, and the bill floats. The bill gets signed. The bill disappears and ends up back inside of the card that flew at the beginning of the show. It's a whole thing, and it took me. When did we talk about that at Old North Arcade? Like probably like 2019, 18.
I mean, it may even have been before that, 'cause you know, it I think it actually started kind of in the middle of the pandemic.
Well, it had to have been. I did.
Because it was shortly after Farrell came to lecture.
Yeah, somewhere. I want to say it was probably 19 or whatever. So, but it's taken me 5 years to figure this thing out. I'm not a creator of magic, right? I just because I had that thing, like, no, this has to change. That was the only reason that I kept going with it, and I kept going with it, and I kept going with it. Now it's in a great spot. But the same thing is true with anything else I do. The show tells me if it has to change, basically. Like, I only start to routine things when it has to happen. You know, like, this script makes no sense anymore when it's after this trick and before this trick. You know, it's got to change. And that's when I start writing.
You know, I think something that so our listeners at when we're finished with this conversation are going to get kicked over to a conversation that I had with Christian Engblom, and who is a great creator of magic. And something that I just heard you say that we're going to hear with Christian is, you know, that you spent 5 years working on this trick before you were sort of ready to kind of like let it sort of like out of the bag, so to speak. Not like releasing it, but even just like performing it in front of magicians.
The
And
methods changed 50 times,
yeah.
you know, so.
And I think it's interesting how often magicians will sort of work at a trick and work at a trick and work at a trick for years and years and years before they really start showing it to people. I mean, you know, I've got this ambitious card that I do with a blue back that magicians really like now. But I mean, I think I worked on that for 3 years before I showed it to anyone. Like before I showed it seriously to people, when people would be like, do a trick and this has become the one that I do. What keeps you going back to a trick and working on it for so long? Because it's easy to just be like, all right, it's there, it's done. I'm not gonna touch it anymore. But there's some that we keep playing with.
I guess for me it's I don't have a whole lot of like signature original pieces. I know people know me for certain things, but you know, this bill and card thing just be kind of came, there's got to be a way to do it. There's got to be a good way to do this. There's got to be a good way to do this. I wasn't happy with any method, so I guess that was kind of just it. And because I force myself to go do shows all the time, like I will, when I'm preparing, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna do the Bill. It's in this show. You have no choice. You can't back out. What are you gonna do? The Bill and Lemon, right? So it's got a bit of an element of like forcing yourself to do it. I think at one point I probably wanted to give up on it. I'm sure I did. There was definitely moments where I didn't have it correct, but you know what? But there's no. When I first started working on it, I didn't think I'd be working on it this long. You know, I'm not like, okay, in 5 years I'll have this. It's just, okay, I'm gonna work on this now, and this is fun. I know people these days really get kind of bogged down. We're like, I needed to learn this yesterday, you know, type of thing. I guess I feel lucky that I don't feel that way. If I start working on something, I don't know what. It's all fun to me. These are all magic products for projects. So like. If I'm doing something 10 years later, it's fine by me.
There is something different about having to learn a trick for work that you know you're going to teach versus working on an original piece for yourself that has like an open-ended timeline, right? Like I wonder if the sort of putting it in the show forces pressure on it, forces you to work on it the same way that like a release date deadline forces you to work on some product. And I wonder if a little bit it's that like we kind of need that pressure
Yeah,
to
you do.
cause like weird things to happen in your brain for those like moments of those flashes of genius and brilliance to come through that you can grab.
No, you're right. And like, there's things about the bill and card or the, you know, magnetic cards or whatever trick you're working on that you'll only learn on stage. You know, you can't learn it writing it down or sitting at your desk. You just can't. Like, all of a sudden you'd be on stage, like, oh, it's so much. They don't see my hand go in the pocket, you know, or like whatever, you know, you can't know it any other way. That said, you know, this bill and card thing, I know right now, at some point I'll probably release it because it's very cool. The device that does it is very, very cool. But I know when I have to teach it, there are like three routines that I have not even thought about once. You know, because I know the routine that I'm doing with it now cannot be the main routine on the video, not because I'm trying to hold it back from you. It's just, you're never going to do it. It's layered into my show in a million different ways.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to step back and actually create like really baseline routines for this thing that I don't even know what they are at the moment, but in doing so will make me better at the trick, you know? So I know this is going to come around and help me routine my own trick that I created and, you know, all of that, but
I can already see myself having to do the same thing for the magnetized cards, where it's like the presentation that I use is like fun, but it's so specific to me that I need to create different routines so people can like find cards and do, you know, have it like cut to the four of a kind or whatever. It's going to be, it's a whole different thing.
And our friend Chris Hanwell can come up with 50 ideas in like one afternoon, right?
Yes.
Wild stuff that I, with methods, right? My brain does not do that. Yeah. You know, people ask me about Nemesis all the time, and Nemesis literally came from, I am writing a book on the Svengali deck, right? And I'm trying to fill the book with routines and plots that I know work with the ideas that I'm presenting. Mm-hmm. Nemesis happened to be one of those ideas. It just made more sense to actually change the deck a little bit and release it as a full product. I did not come up with like lightning strike Nemesis as a trick. It was, I'm working on this project. Okay. All right. How do I teach like a do as I do plot with this? Huh? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then it's just there all of a sudden, you know, it wasn't it's a creative process, but it's more pressure based, I guess.
It's just so funny how pressure really knocks things loose in ways that you would never, ever think. I mean, like, you know, how long did I sit with the FISM routine until it was like 3 months to go and we completely re-choreographed everything? The invisible cards at the end was your idea maybe 6 weeks before the competition. And it was getting it closer and realizing that we have to make, that it's go time that just... I don't know. Makes the brain chemistry different.
I had always, when I got in and I started performing, I realized very quickly that I always wanted to have a performance date on the calendar at all times. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a show date on the calendar for whatever, open mic, literally anything, doesn't matter. You never have that axe hanging over your head, you know? Which keeps me going, because I won't work on my show if I don't have a date on the calendar. You know, I'll think about it all the damn time, but I won't actually axe to grind. I get a show, you know, at the end of next week, and it's like this week, I'm like, okay, what do I have to order to make sure that I have everything to work on the show next week? Mm-hmm. So it's just, I'm always living under that. And by the way, do I have one? Okay, yeah, I do have one of those. I thought about that for a second. I've been doing Henry Harris's cube and bottle, and it is,
oh yeah,
oh man, is that a cool trick. And I just wanted to make sure I had an actual cube and a bottle over there. Yeah, that is a great trick.
I'm gonna be in Nashville in a couple of weeks, and I'm just like, God, is there anything else I need to design and create for that show before I like go out and do it? And
And you want to like bring stuff that you maybe goes in the show, or like, you know, what can I bring? I always overpack. Do you overpack? Like,
oh yeah,
it all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, why did I bring all this?
There was the last time I was in Nashville, I was bound and determined to get Nicholas Lawrence's vanishing card into the show. And I did for like four shows, but I couldn't work it so that it worked, but it was like, but I did it on stage in front of people. And,
I'm putting myself in your shoes in Nashville. I had just gotten iThump, which is a great app that you can download. It's not a Penguin thing, but and I've been doing an iThump routine to my show forever at this point. Mm-hmm. And the old, like, if you saw it, you'd be like, wow, I cannot believe he's getting all of that out of iThump. But literally all I'm doing is I forced myself to use every feature, you know? That's it. Now it's more refined than that now, but when I started in Nashville in that condo there, where I'm like, should I try this thing tomorrow? I think it would work. I just literally did it, you know, just did the, no real, God, I should go back and look at the script. It's probably terrible, but it doesn't matter. Cause like, I can't have it where it is today without the terrible script of you know, the first time I did it.
You know, we're sitting here talking about this right now, and I have a thermal printer that I've been screwing around with, but I haven't gotten to do anything with it. Now, I do have a plan to duplicate the receipts at town hall, and then I want to figure out how to use it so I can like print the receipt off and then pass it to the server for the table and then have her bring it in the bill and then notice that the bill is incorrect because it's matching, like, cause it doesn't ring up their stuff. It rung up the four cards that they printed or that they picked.
Something like that. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think now I need to force myself to go, all right, how do I insert the printer into the show in Nashville next week so that I'm forced to use it? And we'll see what sort of, you know, diamonds come out of that pressure.
I did that. In Nashville. Yeah. I did that.
It's a great venue for it too.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't quite unlock it. So I want to know what you end up doing with it.
Hey, we'll figure it out. Well, Nick, thanks for talking to me about routining. I think it's time for me to kick it over to a conversation between myself and Christian Engblom. Thanks as always to Nick for joining me on the show. Now, on to the main event. Christian Engblom is known around the world as the Big Finish. This titan of magic is one third of the Fat Brothers with Danny DeOrtiz and Miguel Angel Gea, the creator of Triple C, The Cooler, a student of Juan Tamarez, and a fooler from Penn and Teller. Christian is well known for his wild creativity as well as his ability to perform in 5 different languages. I grabbed some of his time via Zoom, and now you get to join our conversation. Christian Engblom, thanks so much for joining me here on the Penguin Magic Podcast. I can't believe that I haven't had you on yet, because I first met you when we taped Fool Us together, and you were just machine gunning magic at me, and then you went out and fooled the daylights out of those guys.
It was a fun day, and it was great meeting you there, actually. We had an awesome time backstage. It would have been so boring sitting there for a few hours waiting on our turn if it weren't for us sitting there and talking magic.
It was my pleasure. And I before we get into some of the other stuff, I just want to relate this story. My partner at the time had come with me, and she was in the audience, and I was the last person to film in our block, and they sort of, you know, push you out the back door and you got to walk around the casino, and I'm in a bar and I'm waiting for her, and she comes running up to me and she says, "You were wonderful, but oh my God, did you see Christian? His pockets disappeared." She was so tickled by your performance. It was just really great.
Oh, I'm happy to hear it. Thank you. Good to know. It strokes my ego in a nice way.
I've wanted to have you on because I keep hearing about you as one third of the world famous Fat Brothers. Can you tell
I'm more like half, because I'm bigger than the other two guys.
Can you tell us what the Fat Brothers are?
Can I what?
Can you tell us what the Fat Brothers are?
Sure. I mean, I met Miguel Angel Gea a long, long time ago, but there was a language barrier. We met at 4F. Factor's Finger Freaking Frolic. That's a tongue twister. And we always seemed to like each other. We did magic for each other, but we didn't really talk. So I knew him. And then I moved to Spain, south of Spain, for about 6 months. I asked Juan, he's Spanish, he knows. So I asked him, are there any magicians in the south of Spain that I should, you know, or that I could session with that are good, interesting, and dedicated? And he said, maybe a few. And he gave me this name and number of Danny DeOrtiz. So we met. It's a funny story how we met, because he lived in a different city, and I lived in Fuengirola. He lived in Estepona, and there's about an hour, 15-minute drive difference. And he didn't speak a word of English. I didn't speak a word of Spanish. And somehow we were able to, on the phone, set up a meet on a specific day, specific time, in Malaga train station.
Wow.
I have no idea how that worked out. All I know is he was there, as was I. And we had our first session in Malaga in a bar. What he showed me, he just blew me away. It was amazing. He is amazing. But at that time, nobody outside of Spain knew of Danny. You know, they just didn't know. Mm-hmm. Now, Miguel Angel and Danny are very good friends and have been for a long time. So I started slowly learning Spanish because I wanted to communicate with Danny, and Danny started slowly learning English. So to this day, we have this thing where when we talk on the phone, I speak in Spanish to him, and he answers in English back to me.
Oh, wow.
So, and it's natural. We just do it. We keep doing it, and it's always been what we've done. So, if you hear us speaking on the phone, one guy on his side, they're going to think that he's speaking, to an English-speaking fellow magician. And on my side, they're thinking I'm speaking to someone who doesn't speak a word of English because I, but it was funny. Anyway, so Danny and Miguel Angel, they had some projects together. One of them was a festival in a little town, 2 day festival, and Danny said, "Would you like to come along?" And I said, sure. And we went there and did close-up magic in a bar, and there were some other performances, and spent a couple of days with like five, six magicians. It was great. So we bonded more, and then we went to the US. Well, actually, I'm jumping ahead of myself. Danny to make a DVD with me together, and I was always thinking, well, what do you need me for? I mean, you got amazing material. And he goes, no, do it together. He'll come to Finland. We can film it in Finland. Oh, sure. So the first country Danny ever lectured in outside of Spain was Finland.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's where we filmed Qué Raro. So that was me and Danny. We
Yes.
were a bit younger and thinner back then. Even though we were about to be the Fat Brothers, because then after that we started, doing something together with Miguel Angel, and the three of us went on a tour in the U.S. Doing lectures and performances, not as Fat Brothers yet, but we were filming a DVD, and at one stop where there was a magic convention, we just we decided that, look, we're like brothers. And we're a little bit chubby. Let's call it Fat Brothers. So, okay, Fat Brothers it is. And on the spot, we also decided we were having so much time doing this filming that we're going to make another one called The Thin Brothers. So we all made a vow to lose weight starting right away at this convention. Can't now remember the name of it for the heck of it, but we went on a diet. And we ate nothing but salads, didn't drank no sodas. We were strict. But that same evening, oh, the idea of the Thin Brothers was that the ending of the Fat Brothers is we go in the box fat, close up a big, cardboard box, and the beginning of Thin Brothers is we open the same box and we come out baggy clothes and and thin.
That is real commitment to a very specific joke, and I love it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how committed we were, because that night there was a huge gala party at the convention, and there was free beer, wine, pizzas, hot dogs, and we just decided to, raise our glasses and toast our commitment to losing weight and celebrate. And the second DVD that we did together was Fat Brother 2, and we had gained a little bit of weight, so now it was 400 kilos of good magic instead of Thin Brothers. And we actually filmed in material for Fat Brothers 3 as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, many years ago, but it's been sitting in Danny's vaults, just waiting for the right time to come out. DVDs are sort of out. So I don't know how we're going to release it, and maybe we'll reshoot something, because it's been so many years. It's been like 6 years since we shot Brothers 3.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's safe to say that Fat Brothers is very much a creative collaboration between the three of you. It's not like a performing group where you're like touring a show. Is that?
Well, it can be, could be. That was a thought at one point. That would be nice. We have like three or four routines that we do together, all three of us on stage. So then we're performing at the same time.
Gotcha.
But normally when we don't go to conventions, we'll do one or two of those together, and then we have our solo acts, and we just sort of, it's performer after performer, together performer and together, you know, something like that. I guess we've never really put too much effort into making it into a real theater performance. I think making it very strict into an act that follows the same exact procedure day in, day out, I don't think that's something that, for instance, Danny would like very much. He usually, when he puts up his performance notes, what to perform, he'll put one or two effects and the rest will be improvisation, having fun, doing something crazy, you know. So he doesn't know. And it seems to work for us. And I think we complement each other as performers when we perform together in the same show, because we are different in our performance styles, and we do different kind of magic, different tempo. So it has a nice arc, you know, it's not monotonous.
Yeah.
But more important than that, I think it's the fact that we enjoy our you know, each other's company.
Yeah.
We don't get together often enough. I'd love to hang out with the guys a lot more. But them living in Spain, me in Finland, Danny being probably the busiest magician, you know, outside of the Vegas acts. I'm thinking he's working a lot.
Yeah.
So to find a suitable venue, it usually needs to be a magic convention that wants the three of us.
Yeah.
And so, well,
if anyone's listening, let's make that happen. I want to shift to your material, though. You have such a delightfully creative approach to magic, and you are particularly well known for your card magic. And I'm wondering, how does your creative process start when you're putting a new piece together?
That's an excellent question. Quite honestly, usually it begins with an idea, and I have a starting point and an ending point, and I'm trying to think of how do I get from here to there. Sometimes I can come up with it on my own. Other times I try to look for the, you know, if there's anything else created by anyone else that could apply, that I could apply to that. And often it'll also be someone who just gives me a comment, like Juan has given me several comments, like the last time I was in Fullest just this summer.
Oh, yeah.
I did a Triumph thesis, and it's an excellent Triumph. I used to do a version, a cheek-to-cheek version, that fooled magicians. So, you know, I was very happy with the handling.
Yeah,
I had gaffed the deck in a different way. It wasn't just all backs, you know, half of them. And there was a routine preceded that, which allowed me to switch half a deck in and then half a deck out so that it ended up clean. And anyway, it was a beautiful routine. I even lectured it at one point. But then after I showed it to Juan, he said, it's very good, but I would like you, and this was when I was living in Madrid in 2000, said, I'd like you to go back home and I'll call you next time. And I knew that would be maybe 2 or 3 days. And I'd want you to have to be able to do a cheek-to-cheek Triumph with a normal deck, even one you borrowed, if need be. And that exactly the same, you spread, you close, you spread open again, and they've all turned face down except the chosen card or cards. And the deck should be able to be given, you know, to be examined right away. And I go, okay, thanks a lot. You know, I'm going to go home. I'm going to go home. I'm going to be thinking about this. And in 2 or 3 days, he's going to call me and know that I'm an idiot. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to come up with a method for that. And so I was in panic. Mm-hmm. And that sort of did get my creative juices flowing, I guess, being in panic. So I came up with two different ways to do it, in theory. Mm-hmm. Oh, not in practice. I couldn't do it in practice. So when he called me a couple of days later, I explained to him both methods. And he said, yeah, they'll probably work, both of them. work first on this one, on the other one, he suggested. So I started working on it. That was pieces, and it took me 5 years until the handling was there, until it was just right. But yeah, it got to be right, you know, in a good place. The other method is still not ready. Mm-hmm. I have a video clip, you know, just doing the last bit where it's different. That one is different. I'm hoping I can get it ready at some point, to be able to perform it live, and then to be able to possibly, you know, give it out to the magic community.
Yeah.
But the other version is not like Cheek to Cheek. The other version is very visual. Mm-hmm. I spread the cards. They're mixed face up, face down. And I just wave my hands on top of it, not even touching. Wow. And the cards all turn face down. And immediately, everything is examinable.
That sounds like witchcraft.
Well, I have a video clip of it, but I don't think you can see it through that. No. If I put it on.
No, maybe you'll have to send it to me privately, and then everyone listening will have to just sort of imagine and wonder. 5 years is a long commitment to one trick. Now, I imagine that you're not working every day on that, but how do you keep engaged in working on a trick for that length of time before you're willing to reveal it?
I probably have OCD. something like that, because 5 years to work on an effect. I mean, I don't do it day in, day out, like you said.
Yeah.
Like the other method that I'm still working on, and it's been, 16 years?
Yeah.
And it's not ready. Mm-hmm. It comes into my mind every once in a while. I play around with it every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And then I put it aside again. Mm-hmm. And I'm beginning to understand what Juan said when he showed me a notebook once, where he said he had like a few hundred tricks of ideas that were 30 or 40 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, so I guess I'm not the only one afflicted with that, but I have a difficult time starting something new, mm-hmm. to create something new while something else is unfinished. It's nagging at me.
Gotcha.
So, but there is another routine that we're working on with Paul, mm-hmm. Paul Wilson, together. It's a very fitting with Paul, because it's like a three-card Monty routine.
Yep.
Imagine right now it's at the stage of being, you know, routining, to get the routining there. Mm-hmm. But imagine a Skinner Monty, Michael yep. Skinner's Monty.
Yeah.
But with cards that you can examine anytime you want.
That's fantastic. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
That sounds like something you would work on with R. Paul Wilson, because you two are both so good at coming up with really interesting card gaffes that you just wouldn't expect.
Yeah. Paul has come up with amazing thing, like mm-hmm. fantasy and mm-hmm. All sorts of things. I still carry fantasy in my wallet. You know?
Great trick.
Yeah. It's amazing.
You've mentioned Juan a couple of times. You've studied with Juan Tamarez, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I've studied Juan's magic. Mm-hmm. I've studied his magic. I met Juan back in 1992 for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that's when he made an impression on me. Before then, I didn't really care for card magic too much. It was just really? A couple of... Yeah. Oil Over Troubled Water... No, sorry. Before I met Juan, mm-hmm. there were like two routines, card routines, in my professional repertoire. There was Paul Curry's Out of This World, the very basic version, mm-hmm. and Red Hot Chicago Opener, or Red Hot Mama. Mm-hmm. So these two routines I used to do. Before others, I thought card magic was a bit boring. But when I saw Juan perform, what he did was amazing. It was miracle after miracle after miracle. And he does nothing. He touches mm-hmm. nothing. You do everything. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with that style. So I I actively looked for conventions when Juan, where Juan would be, and I made an effort to travel to go there to see him perform and lecture. And this went on for a couple of years. And then in the end, I saw him at another convention in Sweden. I had just been to 4F, and there was a mutual friend of ours who suggested that I should come to El Escorial, the card magic that Juan hosts. And so I asked Juan, would it be possible? And he said, yeah, sure. And that's how I got invited to go to Escorial, or I invited myself, but ever since I've been welcome. And it's a brilliant thing. I mean, it's only card magic, but some of the best magicians, not just in cards, are there once per year for 3 days sessioning. Then we stay in Madrid for a few extra days and eat well, enjoy the company. Yeah, Juan also he likes to work from Cadiz, the south of Spain, from his summer villa, he calls it the longest running magic convention in the world. He goes there in the beginning of the summer, and he stays until like mid-September. So it's like 3 months of nonstop magic for him. And he has people come over the entire summer, you know. So there's barely a day free when nobody's there. So it's an experience. I cherish the memories from those and look forward to next summer, just in case Juan is watching.
It's interesting to me that prior to seeing Juan, that you card magic didn't fascinate you, because I think in the world of at least marketed effects, you're very closely associated with card magic. And so having, I mean, the cooler and pieces and, a triple C, I mean, these are all like, very, very well known products. And your at the table lecture is very, very cutting edge card magic. So it's fascinating to me that Juan would have had such an impact on you that you would have dove that deeply into card magic just by seeing a performance like that.
Yeah, I mean, I fell in love with not just, the Juan style of performing, but of card magic. Yeah, he ignited the flame and been burning since, yes.
Now, you're from Finland and you speak impeccable English, and I've seen you perform in English, but I have to imagine that you mostly perform in Finnish, in your native tongue, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, mostly I do. I work mostly in Finland. I do travel abroad as well. So occasionally I get to work in Swedish, English, Spanish. I've been to France and performed, but my French is, shall we say, more amusing than
Yes.
effective.
Well, I think the where I'm headed with this is when I see you perform in English, you're very charming and you're able to use idiom and metaphor and wordplay in ways that many English speakers don't. And you're doing this in a second language. What is it like for you? I mean, are you translating your Finnish show in real time, or are you writing separate pieces in English and Finnish and Spanish or Swedish? I mean, that's something that has always fascinated me, is bilingual performers who perform their act in multiple languages, but not just perform it, but perform it well and have a solid command of the other language that they're working in.
Well, I mean, when I'm speaking to you now, I'm not thinking in Finnish or Swedish. It's I'm just blabbing what comes, comes from the mouth or from my thoughts. It's flowing freely, so to speak. I think my Swedish, not Swedish, my Finnish, Swedish, and English are equally strong. So, or equally bad, depending on how critical you are. But yeah, I'm fluent in all three. I think I speak quite well in Spanish and understand, but it's not perfect by any means. And French is like, like that. I can order something at a restaurant. I can maintain a small conversation, but I think the advantage is coming from Finland, first of all, if you want to communicate with anyone from outside of Finland, you got to learn other languages because mm-hmm. in the world, people don't speak Finnish. Mm-hmm. But we're not a huge country. We haven't had colonies all over the world, so people just don't speak this language. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I think the fact that we don't dub the Finnish TV or films, they're not dubbed like in some countries.
Yeah.
So we hear everything in the original language, which means that if you're a big film freak like mm-hmm. I am, you watch films in English, in Swedish, in whatever, and even in Japanese, mm-hmm. even though I don't speak Japanese, but I prefer to listen to the actors themselves speak. Mm-hmm. And ever since a small child, I've watched movies, you know, Meet Tarzan, Eugene, mm-hmm. but in English. And I guess I have an ear for languages. Mm-hmm. So I've always learned them by speaking and listening mm-hmm. and being corrected in real time. I'm really bad at learning from grammatics, you know, trying to learn rules, mm-hmm. Verbs, irregular verbs and what have you. It's like, well, what? So I can't learn a language like that. I can only do it through speaking. And it doesn't hurt that I've, you know, been in the US as an exchange student for 10 months. Mm-hmm. That was back in 89, 90. I was in Nebraska, a little town called Gordon, Nebraska.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. 2,000 people only there. It was a culture shock, even though I don't come from a country with a lot of people, but it was fun. It was fun. And, yeah.
So when you're putting together your show, you are putting together a general script and then just and putting it out as you're saying it in real time in whatever the language is. And how do you handle doing different jokes and different references that may or may not be pertinent to a culture? Or are you just sort of avoiding that altogether?
Well, I mean, there are some jokes that play with words that don't work. There's a joke in Finnish that I do during one routine that I could never do in English, just mm-hmm. wouldn't translate. So you think of other things, mm-hmm. you know. And when you do your routines long enough mm-hmm. and often enough in a different language, mm-hmm. you start, you know, picking up. Sometimes the audience member will give you a gag that you can take and use in your next performance. And you just have to be, you know, present and listening, I guess. But yeah, when I do a script, I'm a horrible theater performer in that sense that I very seldom adhere to a script word by word.
Yeah.
Like Max Maven was amazing at that. Mm-hmm. Eugene Berger. But their sets were really tight. Mm-hmm. So me, I guess I'm a little bit too relaxed to do a really tight set. Although I am speaking with a director here in Finland to plan a one-man show.
Really?
Finnish and Swedish and English. Mm-hmm. But I have a nagging sensation that he's going to want me to have a strict script with the pauses here and the words there. And so it's going to be... It's out of my comfort zone, so to speak. But yeah, why not? I'll give it a try.
I'd be excited to see a one man show from you. And I would really be excited to see the process of you frustrating a director by not adhering to your own script.
I think I'm gonna have to at least try to. I mean, when I was at Foolus this summer, mm-hmm. The producers had helped. With the script, they wanted me to emphasize some things in the script mm-hmm. simply because the Triumph had been performed so many times on Foolus. They wanted it to be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So we worked on a script, and I had it all written down. And as I hate, it's a strong word, I know, but as I very much dislike to have a script that I need to adhere to, I didn't really learn it in time. Like day before the taping, I started really reading it, started to try to remember what's on it. And when I did the rehearsals, oh, it was horrible. I mean, I couldn't remember this or that, and I said the wrong things here, and my performance started to drag in the practice, in the rehearsal, and I even flashed a thing I shouldn't have flashed because the table they provided me and the chair, there was a huge discrepancy. So I was sitting with my hands up here instead of normally. So it was difficult. And then fortunately, one of the main producers, Andrew, came in backstage. This was last summer, and said, Christian, forget about all of the script. Forget about that. Just be yourself. We want you to be yourself, your own bubbly personality. And that's it. And that was so reassuring. And that's one of the reasons why I love Foolus. I think it's a magnificent TV show where they really care about you as a performer. They wanted me to learn the script. They wanted me to do it. But since it didn't feel right, they just said, forget about it. Just be yourself. Don't try to force that on. Just do what you do. And in the end, I was able to put a lot of that script in there because I felt the pressure was off. Mm-hmm. And I could just, you know, try to be me as much as possible. So
that's a wonderful story. And one that I hear often, that I think that those people do a great job working with magicians.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. I mean, I've been asked to go on America's Got Talent and Britain's Got Talent. Thanks to Foolus.
Yeah.
However, having experienced Got Talent format once in Finland and once in Spain, I am convinced that it is the wrong format for me.
Yeah.
I just don't feel that they can provide me the right setting to do my kind of magic. So I've turned them down each time for that particular reason, no other.
What do you feel is the right setting for your magic? I'm curious, not even from a television standpoint, but for your personal magic, because I've never really thought about the perfect setting for what I want to do. And I'm curious because it sounds like you have had that thought.
Well, it depends where. I mean, if I'm doing a corporate show and I do close-up magic, I often suggest to them, depending on the venue, if it's possible, if they have other, you know, interesting activities in there, I suggest them to put me in a corner with a nice velvet-clad table, chairs around, and make it into one of those private little close-up shows, and do a 20-minute show, and then the next group in, you know, let them come if they want. And that works really nice. It's a nice feeling. That's a preferred way to do in a corporate show. I do walk around and table hopping as well, but it always sort of feels nicer for the performer to have your base and have the audience come to you.
Yeah.
Also, if the audience comes to you, it's because they really want to see what you do. When you do table hopping, there might be people who aren't really appreciative, who don't want to be disturbed or whatever the reason is. So since we're talking about what I would like, that setting, for instance, I would like on TV, I would love to do the kind of close-up magic that we see Juan did on Chantarachan and all of these TV with the people around him, but with a table and people close up and do close-up magic like that. I think that's a brilliant way to do it. If you do it in a theater, can't really do it as easily. But Juan he once gave me a two-hour lecture on how to set up the screen and the camera if you do close-up. And I tell you right now, most magic conventions and theaters in the world, like 99.9% of them, do it, I wouldn't say wrong, but in a much worse way.
I completely agree with you. And it, and a lot of times it's just, it, it is very simply that they don't have the camera high enough. That camera has to be really high so that you can get the same perspective of looking down on the table as though you were sitting there. And so often it's like dead level with the magician and you just lose everything that's happening on the table.
But Juan had like a lot. I'm trying to condense into a couple of minutes what he told me about. Starting with the screen. You shouldn't use a square screen. Because what is a square screen? A square screen is a TV. A spotlight is round. So if you use a round screen, then it already is not a television set. So you have that emotion. It can be something else. So I'm strict about that these days. When I perform, I always want to have that. If they don't have it, well, you can't do it. You can't help it. But Juan travels with his own. That's how dedicated he is. He doesn't care. He'll take his own, right? If I go to US, I'm not going to want to carry that stuff with me. But that's what he does. And he thinks that's much, much, you know, stronger. Then there's more. The camera that he uses focuses only on the tabletop with the black close-up pad. And that round thing, the screen is set very close to him, behind him, but next to him, but very close. The reason being that people's eyes can just shift a little bit between the screen and him. And here's the thing. If he doesn't put the hands on the table, the screen remains black. If there's nothing on the table, it remains black and uninteresting. So people watching him in the face. And when he does something with the hands, now all of a sudden they see the movement on the screen, so they look at the screen. But because their movement is so small, and when he removes the hands, they look back into his face, people don't even have the sensation that they've been watching a screen at any moment. They feel that it's a lot more intimate, even though it's for 1,000 people. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. These are the kind of thoughts that he had on the ideal setting of close-up magic in a theater.
That makes me want to redesign what my show is, because I remember seeing Juan perform and seeing that round screen and being fascinated by it. But the, you know, I have a green table. Now I kind of want to have a black table so that I can do something like that.
I guess it can be green. I mean, as long as it's uninteresting, as long as people aren't looking at it when nothing is happening on top of it.
Yeah, well, I guess that it also depends on what your backdrop is. Because when I saw him, it was a black backdrop. And so a black table is just going to sort of melt away when his hands are not on there. So if it was just, if you had a green table or a blue table and you had a blue backdrop or whatever, or a green backdrop, then it's going to fit. But it's just it's a brilliant thought process. And the round screen is probably less jarring on the eye because our eyes are drawn to corners and rectangles, and it's just so brilliant. I just thought it was cool looking at the time, but the thought that went into that is really fascinating.
Oh yeah. So like I said, 2 hours and I didn't fall asleep. Yeah. So it was a very interesting lecture. So this is one of the reasons why I think Juan is such a master that he is. Why I adore him, not just as a person, but as a magician. I really feel that man is a genius. And you're comparable to Da Vinci or what have you. I mean, he could have been anything. He could have been a movie director, but he chose magic. And he has very deep thoughts about these. Yeah.
I know R. Paul Wilson has been working on a documentary on Juan for a number of years now, and it's pretty close to being finished. And I'm very excited because I know that most magicians don't really understand the position that Juan occupies in Spain. And most people in Spain don't understand the position in magic that Juan occupies. And it'll be really fascinating to have these two different groups realize that he is so revered in such different ways in different areas of the world.
Yeah.
Well, I have one more question and then I'll let you go, because I feel like I could talk to you all day, but you've mentioned a couple times now that Finland is not got many people, is fairly small. And I don't normally ask people on this how they got into magic, but I have to imagine that the Finnish magic publishing scene is pretty small as well. And so how did you get involved in magic, and was it your propensity for languages that helped you to gather so much knowledge and skill relatively quickly?
Well, yeah, it does help that you can read in other languages, but the first magic trick I ever learned, I was 3.5 years old. Mm-hmm. And I had already by then, I realized that magicians do impossible things, seen them in shows. And then I was traveling by train through Europe with my mother, and somewhere in maybe Germany, some young student decided to show me a magic trick, mm-hmm. 3.5 years. It was a trick with a box of matches where he opened the matchbox, you know, with the European matches made of wood, right? Mm-hmm. He opened the sleeve, removed it halfway so I could see the matches. He turned it upside down, removed the sleeve completely. And the matches that were inside the box, they didn't fall down. He shook the box, they didn't fall down. I could hear them rattling inside. Mm-hmm. And when he snapped his fingers, boom, they all fell down. And I could immediately examine everything.
Wow.
So it was I was like, wow. But I knew that this young kid is not a magician. I mean, I just saw something amazing. Something impossible, but you know, he was a student. So as a young kid, I was curious, so I asked him how he did it, and he wouldn't tell me. Mm-hmm. His big mistake was doing this on a train where he or I, neither one of us, were getting off that train for hours. And I can be persistent. So in the end, he folded and showed me how it worked. So that's how I learned.
Oh, wow.
And then when I came back home, of course, I had some magic boxes and what have you. And by the time I was 5, I auditioned to perform on TV, Finnish TV.
Wow.
With these magic box sets, you know, doing a vase and rope and what have you. So I did an audition for the TV execs, and they thanked me very much and sent me away. I didn't hear it back from them, so I guess they weren't too convinced from me. Mm-hmm. You know, the 5-year-old, they figured, I guess, I wasn't quite ready yet. But then they called and said they want to do an interview. They want me to do magic while I'm being interviewed for the radio.
Oh.
So I got to perform magic while being interviewed for the radio, but I wasn't ready for TV yet. and the interviewer was explaining what she's seeing and going, oh. So this was in the 70s, mid-70s.
Wow.
So anyway,
yeah.
I digress.
Mm-hmm. What are the sources that you're learning from in? I think the reason I ask this question is that I get a lot of young people on Instagram reaching out to me and saying, hey, my English isn't great. You know, where can I learn magic? And I don't know what to tell some of these young kids from parts of Europe or Asia or South America who are asking me for advice. And so I have to imagine that growing up in Finland in the 70s, there wasn't a ton of Finnish magic published. So what were the sources you were going to?
The library. I mean, magic books, all public libraries carry a few magic books, mm-hmm. and some of them are pretty good.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what happened to me. I got while I was in the US as a exchange student, mm-hmm. in 89, 17, turning 18. And I got my hands on a book that my mother came to visit. Her boyfriend brought it with him, mm-hmm. a Swedish magic book, Åke Hallberg. was the writer's name, and the magic tricks, they were great. There were card tricks, there were match tricks, there were, you know, all sorts of tricks, and I immersed myself in that.
Yeah.
And when I got back home to Finland, I just went to the library and started getting books. So for 2 years I was doing nothing but learning from books in a library. Mm-hmm. And only then did I realize at the end of one of those books, there was an address and name of a Finnish magic dealer.
Oh.
And I realized, oh, Marko Purho. Mm-hmm. Oh. So he does magic. I wonder if he's still, because the book was old, I wonder if he still does this. So I found him, called him and said, yeah, he's got a shop and we have a convention coming up. Would you like to come? So, oh, so I got to meet magicians by doing that.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that's how it sort of started.
And the rest is history.
Well, the rest is learning.
Learning.
Learning. And I'm still learning.
Yes.
I mean, I love to, I mean, I buy new magic all the time.
Yeah.
Penguin, you know, I'm from wherever. Whenever I see something amazing, I'm going, oh, and I toy around with it. I don't use all of it, but everything that I get, every new bit of information is something that increases my knowledge in magic and that may someday aid and help in me finding a solution to an effect of my own.
Yeah.
That's why even if magicians buy effects that they don't use, I still think it's money quite well spent. It's an education you're getting.
Yeah.
You may not get a product that you'll ever use as such, but you're getting an education. And that's something that is still difficult to find. I mean, to find the right stuff, what to get. I mean, if something becomes a product, most likely it's going to have some good idea about it. Otherwise, it would seldom be produced as a product, you know, or as at least not sold readily all around the world in magic. So,
I think that that's a very, knowing the meetings that I'm in as a magic producer, we're always asking what is the cool thing here? What is the interesting thing that is valuable and worth putting out? And I think that, you know, obviously I have a vested interest in people buying magic tricks because of my employer, but I do think that that's a really beautiful statement of what you're getting from these things that you're buying is not just a collection, but an education. And I think that that's a great way to look at it.
It really is. It really is. I mean, it's so easy to think that it's another trick for the drawer.
Yeah.
You know, but no,
you might,
it's another
you might
little bit of information for you.
Yeah.
And you use it or you don't use it. Maybe it's not the right trick for you, but you're getting that education.
Yeah. Well, Christian, thanks so much for taking some time to talk to me. We'll have to have you back on to discuss creativity and other things another time. But thanks so much for joining us here on the Penguin Magic Podcast.
Hey, thanks for the invite. Thanks, Eric. Hope to see you soon.
Of course. See you soon. That's going to do it for this week, kids. Thanks so much to Christian Engblom for being on the show, and thanks to you for listening. Well, the rumors are true. The Penguin Awards are coming back, and there will be an official nominee video and date announced soon. Keep an eye on our Facebook page for more information. I'm about to head out to Nashville to perform at House of Cards and bring some cool new magic to the masses. I look forward to seeing all of the Penguin fans there. As always, we're a weekly podcast, so be sure to like and subscribe as well as share your favorite episodes on the social media platform you've been showing off weird 3D printed keycaps for your mechanical keyboard on. If you wanted to reach out to me about anything on this week's show, you're gonna have to seriously overlook the fact that my alt key is now just Shrek's head. Like, it's legitimately just Shrek's head. Why would anyone let me have access to a 3D printer and the internet? But if printing classic Mike Myers characters to adorn your keyboard isn't your cup of tea, you can always hit me up on Instagram at Eric Tate. That's at E-R-I-K-T-A-I-T. From me and everyone else here at the P3 Magic Studios, practice, perform.